like a friend. Because sometimes, you know, we're overtaken by the distance between the way we think and where we're located mentally, and what the Srimad Bhagavatam is saying. In fact, there doesn't seem any bridge. The subject matter is way up here and we're somewhere else. Our thoughts are all about life and Srimad Bhagavatam. There just doesn't seem to be any bridge. So I just was reflecting this morning on a couple of experiences that I personally had that gave me an opportunity to develop a sense of relatedness to the Bhagavatam. And the first one was when I was married, which was it was an arrangement of marriage, and I hadn't met my husband before. We met in Hong Kong, where we were married and so forth. And it was quite an uncommon experience, not one that I would wish on anyone, myself. Because you were sort of already, it was imposed, the relationship was imposed, and you didn't really know who it was that you were now in this relationship with. So it was unusual. And as a result, we had to, there was only one devotee, the one who married us, and then he left. So there was me and him. And I didn't know how to cook, which I never thought was a very important thing, until I realized that three times a day you have to eat. And all of a sudden it was overwhelming, because three times a day, of course, the newly married husband looks at the newly married wife, and the newly married wife says, I hope you're not looking at me. And he thinks, uh-oh. And so we had our difficulties getting everything to become practical. And one of the things we used to do, because it was, I needed some outlet, because here I was, there were no other devotees there. I was still very new as a devotee, so there was a very strong sense of structure. As later on in life one becomes a little more liberal, but it was everything had to be done properly, and there I was in the situation. So at that time we had the first canto. That's all we had. That was all that had been published by Srila Prabhupada. And I had brought it with me. And it was like me and the book and him. It was like there was only three of us. And so what I would do is, when I didn't feel like exchanging with this person who I didn't really know, I would go with the books. And I took them aside. And it was quite lonely, isolated situation. I was quite young, needed some outlet for intelligence and so forth. So I started reading, and I found there were some verses or little words here and there that inspired me. So I got a little notebook, something not dissimilar to the books that you have. And for want of a shelter and another way to deal with life, I cut off little corners on the pages, and I put a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4. And then the front page I put 1, 2, 3, 4, and I would add subject topics as I would read. In other words, I would read for a long time, because I didn't have much structure to my life then, and I would find something that inspired me. It just sort of triggered, oh, that's interesting. And because there was time to do it, it was a very unusual circumstance, a very negative on one side, often turns out to be a very positive on the other, if you can just capture it, grasp hold of it. Well, I felt like I wasn't grasping hold, I was being dragged along by it. But anyway, somehow or other, this is what I found myself doing. So I would find a verse, and it was really nice, and it was about something about the value of hearing. So I would write on this little one, I'd write hearing. And then, from then on, I'd look in the Bhagavatam for quotes about hearing. And at the same time, I'd find new quotes, something about Kali Yuga, something that really struck me. So then the next number two, I would write Kali Yuga. So now I was looking for quotes about hearing or Kali Yuga or anything. And so I would read, find something else that just moved me in some way, and I would write it down, and I would pop that in there. And so after a while, I had many headings, because sometimes I don't find any more quotes on that particular thing. Anger. Oh, that's an important one. I've got that one down. And gradually what happens, I would spend as much time as possible doing this, because I didn't have much to speak to him. And so then my husband saw me doing this all the time, and it looked like a very edifying thing to do. So he got a little book. And he had all numbers. And we used to sit for hours, you know, because we had to talk to each other. We might sit at one end of the table, and we'd sit at the other, and we would just fiddle away and write little quotes in. And then after some time I lost the book, you know, just in the course of time. And I didn't often read it again, but the process of actually just isolating something and just writing it by hand, instead of clicking on a computer and then printing it, it made it go in deeper into the psyche. So this, I remembered this as like, it was like really my friend, the Bhagavatam's really my friend. When I have a problem, I go there, and I open up the book anywhere I want, and I say, I have a problem, and the Bhagavatam gives me something back. And then I saw that actually this was not incorrect, although of course it was being done in a very immature way, and not in, you know, with a deep understanding of the Bhagavatam's message, but it had somehow or other created the first bridge. And sometime later I was given this 10-in-1 book, and I took it with me when we went to live in Vrindavan. And living in Vrindavan in the beginning was very hard. It was a different culture. It was hot, or it was cold, or it was strange, or I couldn't speak to anyone, or something or another, I was sick, something. So I would take the, in the same way I take the Bhagavatam, and I would underline it, thoroughly underline it. And sometimes people would say to me, you know, you're not supposed to do that to the Srimad Bhagavatam, underline things and mark them and things. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, probably not. But anyway, I kept going. And one day I was in Bombay, and I was in Prabhupada's rooms in Bombay, and I saw something that gave me a great deal of comfort. I saw that he had a Bhagavad Gita, which is on display if you go to his rooms, and he's underlined it and written things because it was a study book. He was using it for the purpose of study. Now, I have never done that, and nor do I recommend anyone to do that with the very stately Srimad Bhagavatams that we have, all in the 10th canto, 12 cantos, because they have a particular demeanor of dignity about them, that I've never done that. But this book has remained like a friend. And now if you look at this book, you see it's so old, it's falling apart. But any time if somebody says to me, could you have to give a class or something, and I'm thinking, oh, I pick it up and I just read the underlines. I don't even prepare. I just read one underline after another, and I know that there'll be something striking in that. And there is. And people say, oh, that was very nice. And I think, oh, that was very clever. It all turned out to be quite practical. So this is what I want to show you how to do with these. I want to go through these texts that I've given you, and I want you to do that. I want you to feel free to write on them, to underline them, to put question marks on them, to scribble on them, but not, of course, in a with a disrespectful mind. Now, sometimes I approach the Bhagavatam, if I'm having some trouble or if I'm not in very good consciousness, I'll approach it in a not a very good state of mind. But I approach it in a not very good state of mind, hoping that my state of mind might be uplifted. And I remember when Srila Prabhupada was present in 1976 in Melbourne, I just had a baby. I was living outside the temple. I wasn't as fit as I could be spiritually. There were many things that weren't going on just right as they should be. And so when Srila Prabhupada came, I felt like running 100 miles, and the last person I wanted to see was him. And because it just emphasized how embarrassing it was to have my mind totally preoccupied with all sorts of other things. And still, I had to go to the temple and act appropriately and so on and so forth. And because I was myself cloudy because of all the various things that were happening in my life at that time, I didn't feel like getting any closer than the general public. But my husband and I, we knew him because of our service in Hong Kong. He knew us. And seeing us there, he wanted to talk to us, how are we, and so on and so forth. So I was very much pulling back. And then I would say to my husband, because I could tell him all my complaints and grumbles rather than the problem, oh, I just don't feel this and I don't feel like that and I don't know about this. And my husband had said very enthusiastically, Prabhupada, we're not doing very much here in Melbourne. We're just living as a family, taking care of our family, griha, again, in a very fervent way. And he said, I want to be one of your preachers and, you know, forget all of this and we'll go to America and I can manage a temple for you. And I was thinking, oh no, you know, it was like the last thing that I wanted. So I had a lot of reservations and I was holding back. And so each time I'd see Srila Prabhupada, I would think, how do I, and I couldn't really figure out how to express what I was feeling, but I could now say, without the painful emotions of the time, How do I express my doubts? I just don't really know if I want to do what he says. I don't really know if I want. I had many, many doubts. And everybody's jumping up and down. You can imagine, you might be sitting here with a doubt, but everybody's kind of quiet and subdued. When Srila Prabhupada would come somewhere, everyone's jumping up and down and crying, and oh, Prabhupada, and there's a fervency going on. And here's me sitting there with my, you know, I'm not sure about these things. I'm not sure if I fit into this. And so it was very difficult. And then I would listen to Srila Prabhupada in a different way, like a defensive way. I didn't really want to listen to him at all, I have to admit, because of the confrontation where I was situated. But as I was listening, I heard him say something that put me, threw me back, way back. He said, "Don't bother your spiritual master with questions and questions and questions unless you want to hear the answer." And I thought, uh-oh. And then I said, that's it. I'm not even coming to another class, because I could see quite clearly that my disposition was, had become in such a state that I didn't really, there's something about when you go down into a negative state of consciousness, is my experience, that there's a part of you that doesn't want to come up. And that's what was happening. There I was in front of him, and he was like the light, and there was a part of me that really didn't want the light in my life, and I was seeing this in the light, and it was making me very confused, because I'm standing in front of the light wanting to get away from the light, but I'm supposed to get, and I was in great turmoil. So we went on like this. We ended up traveling with Prabhupada from Melbourne to Fiji, from Fiji to Hawaii, and that was like the most excruciating torture you could imagine for me. Just imagine when you look back and everyone says, "Oh, you're so lucky you were with Prabhupada," and say, "Yes, I traveled with him," and they go, "Oh." And then you say to them, "It was the most terrible thing I ever did in my life." Because there you were, right next to the light, walking right next to the light, and it was just illuminating in all directions. And there you were, you little dark thing, coming along beside and holding onto your darkness like this and saying, "I'm not going to ask you any questions because you're going to try and get rid of my doubts, and I think my doubts are quite valid," and so. So he got to Fiji like that, and I was in turmoil. My husband was in a very different state of mind. He was very peaceful and trying to let Srila Prabhupada's instructions come in, and I was holding back. And so we had, at a certain point, it culminated in a great sort of an explosion. And my husband and I exploded, and my husband tried to calm me down. And somehow it seemed as though Srila Prabhupada was aware of what was the turmoil that was going on for me. And so he called for me. And that was the worst possible thing he could do in my mind. You know, he called for me, you know, like, you know, he could call him, but don't call me. You know? And he called, the phone rang, and it was one devotee. He said, "Srila Prabhupada wants to see you immediately." I just, like, dropped the whole bundle and said, "I can't come, I'm really sorry, my baby is sick, and I just said, sorry, there's no way I can come." Then he said, "Just a minute," and then he said, "Prabhupada said, when your husband comes back, please you both come." So then I felt like he was going to nail me to a cross, because here he was drawing me forward. And then he, when we came in, I remember he was sitting there, and he looked very concerned, because all of this was going on within the universe of my mind, and it wasn't going on outside, it was going on within. And we walked in, and he said, "What is the problem?" And all of a sudden I was like, "What is the problem?" And the problem seemed to be like, "I don't know what the problem is. I really literally don't know what the..." I fumbled around, I said a few things, I said... But it came out, as it came out, sort of nervously blurting out things, it came in my mind to when I was in Hong Kong. It was very difficult in Hong Kong. And I was there thinking, "Prabhupada is pleased, Prabhupada is pleased, I have to keep doing this," so on and so forth. And at a certain point, it occurred to me that he was displeased. And he was displeased, because we were doing things that were incorrect. He wasn't displeased with us per se. He was displeased with some of the things that we were doing. And at that point, I slipped into a misunderstanding. I took it too far, due to my own immaturity, my youth, and I felt very much like hurt. That, you know, I've done this and this and this, and now he's come. I know I'm not doing this right, and that's not right, and so on and so forth. But still, you know, I'm doing this, 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 and this. How could he? And so a misunderstanding had been born. And when that misunderstanding gradually grew, it grew into something quite large. And it was there between me and Prabhupada. So Prabhupada wanted to speak, so he spoke. And he said, "What is the difficulty?" And my husband said, "I don't think it's my difficulty, it's her difficulty." I was like, "I beg your pardon." Of course it was my difficulty, but I didn't expect it to be placed like that. And then Prabhupada said, "What is the problem?" And then I started to try to bring out to the surface, "Well, you said this and I thought this." And as things were coming out, they were coming. It was awkward because he was so he was such a reverential figure. But he didn't want to speak on a reverential level. He wanted to speak heart to heart. "What's the problem? You're here?" He said, "I'm here. Let us solve this problem for good." So we went through various things. And at the end of it, he gave me simple instructions. Actually, we finished that conversation. He said, "What is the problem?" We talked, and I said things. "I think this, he thinks that." And he was very expert. He blamed my husband for most of it. "Take care of your wife. You know, why don't you take care of your wife?" And I'm sitting there and he's saying, "And you did that? You did that?" And then finally, as the conversation went on, I was thinking, "I think I have to say something here," because he was so expert. He put everything over there. And I finally said, "But Prabhupada, actually it was me who was having the problem all along. It was me who wanted to leave. It was me who was always restless." And then he turned back to me. He looked at me. He said, "So you caused all of these problems in a very innocent way, not in a judicial way." And I sort of said, "Yes." And then he looked at me very gently, no complaint. He said, "Then you suffer." And I said, "Yes," that I could see very clearly. I'd been suffering because of my rebelliousness to the process. So then I thought, that's nice. I felt like something had been lifted, but we'd walked out of the room. It was lunchtime. We had lunch. I thought, is that it? I didn't feel it was quite finished. So he did something very wonderful. After lunch, he rang his bell, even though he normally took rest, and he called us in again. When we sat down again, he said, "Now, what is the solution?" So again we talked. And he went through, and he chastised my husband. "You change your mind all the time. If you change your mind all the time, she'll become disturbed." And he said, "If he changes his mind, just write to me. I'll take care of you. But no one else, he said. "You don't go here and there." He said, "This is not good for you." He went on and on and on, and he gave but in a very loving way, like a father, just adjusting everything and giving some guidelines. So we went on from there, and gradually, over years, basically, we recovered to a sense of relationship. The shame went away for why did we do this, or how did that happen, and so on and so forth. That all vanished with time until you were left with a sense of a very strong relationship, because you had gone through so many things together. It wasn't just a sort of a formal, always went nicely relationship. It had gone through a bit of a tumble, and still the relationship was there. So when we read these, what I would like you to do, because sometimes we're going to read different things, I would like you all to think that your relationship, as we're hearing this, not in any strange concocted way, because we may have spiritual master, we may not, but I would like you to think that you are dealing with Prabhupada now. We're dealing with Prabhupada either as directly his disciple or as his grand disciple. And as his grand disciple, we have a relationship with him because he's the giver of this information. So when we approach the Bhagavatam, we should feel confident of that. Srila Prabhupada is giving this. When he speaks about a realized spiritual master, and it goes beyond our experience, we go here. Stop it. You're making me cry. So we should go to the Bhagavatam, we should go to Prabhupada. All right. Do you have yours? Yes. So what I want us to do is I want us to go through these quotes, and I want us to go through them in this mood. Now the first one is, I think it's on the top. It's the 10-1-10, 2-1-10 quote. Do you have that one? It's a double one. This one is about the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole of the quote with you, because I didn't choose these quotes for the whole quote. I chose them for particular points. So I'm going to emphasize those points. You're welcome to go through them with a pen and paper or whatever you want and find other things in them. But I want to go through specific things. Now, that means I want you to have your pen very near, and I'm going to ask you questions, and I want you to be underlining what is relevant. Starting here with the verse. Okay, Amiatma Prabhu, read the verse, please.
Dharam te vidasyami maha poro shiko bhavan yasya shradaratam sashu janmukunde mati sati.
In the translation?
I shall recite before you, because you are the most sincere devotee of Lord Krishna. One who gives full attention and respect to hearing Srimad Bhagavatam achieves unflinching faith in the Supreme Lord, the giver of salvation.
Yeah, you should underline why this particular Bhagavatam is being recited to this particular person. Keep your eye on your text. And then I want you to isolate what one has to do when hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam with an underline. What one has to do. There's two things here that are mentioned. One who gives, two things, to hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then I want you to underline what one achieves by doing those two things. This is very simple. Please don't think I'm giving you something that you can't understand because it's complicated. Then the purport. We'll go on with the Srimad Bhagavatam purport. Srimad Bhagavatam is recognized Vedic wisdom, and the system of receiving Vedic knowledge is called Avaroha Panta, or the process of receiving transcendental knowledge. Underline, receiving. Through bona fide spirit disciplic succession. For advancement of material knowledge, there is a need for, underline what the two things are, personal ability and researching aptitude. But in the case of spiritual knowledge, all progress depends more or less on the mercy of the spiritual master. And as I said, this spiritual master, in this case, when we're going to be referring to, has to be Srila Prabhupada, because he is the person who's giving us this transcendental knowledge. So we have to go to him to take this form of spiritual master, the gravity and the magnitude of what he is speaking of will be there. The spiritual master must be what? With the disciple. Only then is knowledge, underline, something manifest before the student of spiritual science automatically. Now, here's something we should understand. Now, Prabhupada is speaking next about something specific, but we should understand this in our own context. He says, the process should not, however, be misunderstood to be something like magical feats. Magical feats needs to be underlined. Whereby the spiritual master acts like a magician and injects, you can circle or underline as you like these words, injects spiritual knowledge into his disciple, as if surcharging him with an electric current. This is, of course, referring to Ramakrishna, but we have to see, do we think like this? Do we think somehow or other like this? No, I need a spiritual master, because my spiritual master will do this. He'll do something, it'll just go vut, and all my work will be done. We have to look for these things. The bona fide spiritual master, now underline this, reasonably explains everything to the disciple on the authorities of Vedic wisdom. I think I would underline authorities of Vedic wisdom. The disciple can receive such teachings, not exactly intellectually, I underline that. You because I found that interesting. What does that mean? Not exactly intellectually. But by submissive inquiries and a service attitude, they are important. Because it's not exactly intellectual, what is it? The prophet is telling you. A submissive inquiries and a service attitude. The idea is that both the spiritual master and the disciple must be bona fide. In this case, the spiritual master Sukadeva Goswami is ready to recite exactly what he has learnt from his great father. I underline that. Exactly what he has learnt from his great father Vyasadeva. And the disciple Maharaj Parikit is a great devotee of Lord Krishna. Now here's a wonderful definition. The next three lines I underlined this double. A devotee of the Lord, it's a definition, is he who believes sincerely that by becoming a devotee of the Lord, one becomes fully equipped with everything spiritual. And here's a very powerful statement. This is something, you see, a definition is something that has to go right into your psyche. It's very important because then when you feel, you say, oh, this person's a devotee, that person's a devotee, to see what class of devotee they are means how much of a devotee, how thorough a devotee they are, you have to have a guideline. Do you say, because they do this, this and this, they're a devotee, because they do that, that and that, they're a good devotee? You've got to go to a guideline. That means you've got to go to a definition. So here is a classic definition. A devotee of Lord Krishna is he who believes sincerely that by becoming a devotee of the Lord, one becomes fully equipped with everything spiritual. The more you write as you're going along, the more you put in, the more that the text will reciprocate with you. It's alive. It's not that it's just an intellectual experience. We read that back there. You may have underlined this. It is not exactly intellectual. It is by submissive inquiries and a service attitude. That submissive inquiries means I have to say, I need help. I want to know something. When we don't have that, at that time, then it won't speak to us in the same way. And it will speak to us again the moment we have that. Shastra is like that. Shastra is Krishna. He will speak to us when we want to be spoken to. He will leave us alone when we want to be left alone. But he will, material nature will push and poke us and shove us and squeeze us with an effort to get us to understand our folly in not wanting him to speak to us. So therefore, this is the nature of the relationship we're trying to endeavor to achieve. This teaching is imparted, I'm sorry, this is right after a devotee of the Lord. We go on and say, this teaching is imparted by the Lord himself in the pages of Bhagavad Gita, in which it clearly describes the Lord Sri Krishna is everything. So that I put a big circle around. He is everything. What does it mean, he's everything? How can I bring that into my way of looking at the world? What would it do if I understood this? These questions come in a refreshing way if we're actually following the text. And we can come with doubts as well. I don't believe it. How do I? So many things. Let them come. Because when the doubts arise, Arjuna was there saying to Krishna, nor do we know what is the best thing to do. Fighting in this battle, leaving the battle. He was speaking to Krishna as, you don't know, I don't know. He was in a very doubtful state of mind. But because he spoke to Krishna, and then he heard from Krishna, then he accepted Krishna, then Krishna enlightened him. Now, I'm going to go right to the bottom here, because we want to do a couple like this. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Lord Chaitanya is Lord Krishna himself in his devotional attitude, descended on earth to bestow special favors upon the fallen souls of this age of Kali. Now, I underlined that because I thought it's going to be important for me to remember that Krishna is Lord Chaitanya. When when I hear Krishna, when I hear Lord Chaitanya, to remember they're the same person. And it's going to be important for me to understand that he bestows special favors, because I might need some special favors. And it's also important for me to understand that the people of Kali Yuga who I see around me who are actually very fallen, yes, the Bhagavatam knows of their fallen condition, and he knows that they know of our fallen condition also. So we don't have to feel like, oh, I'm so fallen, I better hide somewhere. We should understand these things. They know. They already know. And they have come to bestow special favors. I'm stopping on this one now. I'm not going into this one further, but I want to take another one. And do the same, and then I want you to write. There's two pages on that purport. The first one goes on to... No, that's a separate one. That's a separate one. Okay, here's a good one. This Maharaj Parikshit one. Maharaj Parikshit, you have that? Did not ask his spiritual master. Yeah, they're different. They're separate. It's another page from another booklet. It's from 246. There's a couple of points in this one, then I'll go to another one. I'm not going to go, I don't want to go deeply into any of them. I just want to show you how you can approach and how you should use the text. Maharaj Parikshit did not ask his spiritual master Sukadeva Goswami to narrate Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. He wanted to hear first about the creation of the Lord. So I underlined that because I'm sure that I'm not alone in this, but a lot of people find the creation a bit boring or irrelevant. It seems technical and it's boring and hard. So we need to know, then why is it in there? You know, why don't we just take that out? We can just read the Krishna book. It's quite that lively and merry. But there's all this technical first air, you know, first the eye, the ear, the this, the that, all the elements, how they're created. So if anyone hasn't read it, then they won't know what we're talking about. But if they do read it, they'll find themselves going, oh, this is really difficult. Because it's so far removed from what we know, we see everything around us. You know, we don't believe that one time, or I should say, I don't believe that one time there was nothing, and then there was a subtle form of the subtle ego was created, then the mode of goodness was created, then the mode of passion, and the intelligence is the mode of this, and this is this, and this. I don't see it this way. So it's a challenge. But Maharaj Parikshit asked about this. So I underlined that. Sukadeva Goswami did not say that the king should hear about the direct transcendental pastimes of the Lord. He didn't say that. The time was very short. He had only a week. We have a very short time too. And naturally, Sukadeva could have gone directly to the 10th canto to make a shortcut of the whole thing, as is generally done by professional reciters. Now, I'm reading quickly. At this time, I'd like you to underline, please, as you do, because the time is very short. But neither the king nor the great speaker of the Srimad Bhagavatam jumped up like the organizers of the Bhagavatam. Both of them proceeded systematically, I underlined that, so that both future readers and hearers might take lessons, I underlined that, from the example of the procedure of reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. Those who are in control of the external energy of the Lord, that means are in the control of the external energy of the Lord, or in other words, I underline this, those who are in the material world, because that's us, what? Must first of all know how the external energy of the Lord is working. You must know how this world works. Under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, how he's in control. And afterwards, one may try to enter into the activities of his internal energy. That means his personal nityalila, his pastimes. First, you must understand how the material world works. So what are the three forces in the material world? Goodness, passion, and ignorance. We must understand these things a little bit. Not in an intellectual way. We read back to the last one. It said not exactly intellectually, but by submissive inquiries and a service attitude. You See how they link together? What you read in one place will support what you read in another place. So here, he's saying that you must understand how the external energy works before you can understand the internal energy. Is this some kind of a binding, like a force? No, it's a fact. You must understand where you are and come from where you are to where the Supreme Lord is. Otherwise, when you try and go up there, you'll have all your concepts from here and you'll just reinforce them up there and you'll make a mistake. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, you'll tumble down again. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada's mood was very strongly like this. He wanted us to take balanced steps forward and always upward. And he wants that the subject matter of Krishna in Vrindavan, the holy dharms, should become ours. But we should come from out of the material ways of thinking to achieve them, not stay where we are and bring them down into our access. Because if we do it like that, we won't make the ultimate benefit that they're meant to give. Now, I went down here to, you can look for this on yours, therefore the neophyte devotee, instead of jumping at once to the platform of transcendental pastimes presented by the internal energy of the Lord, you can find that part, I put an underline down the side of this section, and I underline this, may know how great the Supreme Lord is by inquiring about the process of his creative energy. Then I went down a little further and I saw that Chaitanya Chaitamrita has warned the neophyte to be seriously on guard. I thought that was quite a strong statement. Seriously on guard. If I told one of you that there's someone in this room you should be seriously on guard of, you'd start going like this. Well, here you're being told to be seriously on guard against what? Against the pitfall of neglecting knowledge about Krishna in regard to how great he is. Why? Why is that? Because, I had an interesting conversation with a young devotee who I know very well, who we were reading Bhagavad Gita and we read the 11th chapter. And as a result of the 11th chapter, which is all about the universal form, she said, I don't like this. This is horrible. I don't have to read these things. This is horrible. All this ghastly stuff. I don't like this part of the Bhagavad Gita. And so I said to him, you can't really be like that. You have to like the Bhagavad Gita. You have to understand the Bhagavad Gita. No. This is really horrible. It makes me feel all creepy. This is ghastly. This is God, and I have to worship Him. I don't want to hear this. So I tried to explain to her, you have to understand His greatness in order to understand why you should surrender to Him. So she didn't like that either. So we had a discussion and went on over a period of days. And I started to explain to her, there's a part of you that would like to know God in a very loving way. You would like a very intimate, loving relationship with Him. And that part is fine. There's no question or criticism of that part. But there's also, I've observed in you, a part of you that really is quite an enjoyer of the material energy and likes to have a good time and do all of these things and feels very threatened by the thought that God is up there as the supreme power and you're going to be judged for what you're doing and you're going to end up in having to pay for all of the frivolous things that you're doing. There's a price for them. There's a part of you that's very averse to hearing that. And there's a part of you that's very averse to having the intimate sense of Krishna as your worshipful deity disturbed. And this part I can honor and I will encourage you to continue with that. But this part I'm going to continue to challenge because you can't have these two things. You can't say I want to enjoy the material world and I want to have an intimate relationship with Krishna. And we see this often in the second generation. Those who have grown up children and those whose children grow up, they have a tendency towards this. It's called mixed devotee. I want Krishna and I want to enjoy Maya. And I think that the most wonderful, intelligent person is the person who can situate himself right on the edge and zip out the back door whenever he has a need and out the front door whenever it's required and this is a very intelligent person. So I'm going to go from here, because this is I'm going to move quickly from this one, where it describes that you must know how great he is, because by knowing his greatness you can put your unflinching faith in him. And then I'm going to go to another quote I've given you. I'm doing this in purposely to hurry, but also it's relevant. Now, you have one of the zero, and it says pure devotional service. It's a different type, and it says this. The highest example of pure devotional service, so I underline pure, because it's specifically talking about that, is that of the gopis in Vrindavan. They are not interested in understanding Krishna, but in loving him. Now, doesn't this sound contradictory? Before, we're hearing how we have to understand the greatness of the Lord, and here we're saying that pure devotional service means that you don't want to understand how great he is, you just want to love him. That platform of love is the pure state. I understand that. I understand, underlined understanding, you're not interested in understanding, and I underline loving. And I underline the platform of love is the pure state of devotional service. This is pure devotional service, only love. Now, what happens if you're not on that platform? This is really important for us to understand, because this gives us impetus to go upwards towards it. Prabhupada says, unless one is advanced to this pure state of devotional service, there is a tendency to desire elevation to a higher material position. Now, he's going to use this elevation in terms of an Indian paradigm. So here is the Indian paradigm, so we can listen to it. A mixed devotee may desire to enjoy a comfortable life on another planet with a great span of life such as Brahmaloka. So we don't even think like that. But they want to live for a long, long time in a wonderful heavenly way. These are material desires, but because a mixed devotee engages in the service of the Lord, ultimately, I underlined ultimately, after many lives of material enjoyment, I think there are too many's there, yeah? After many, many lives of material enjoyment, he undoubtedly develops Krishna consciousness. Ultimately, undoubtedly, very strong words. And the symptom of this Krishna consciousness, so we can see this for ourselves, is that he is no longer interested in any sort of materially elevated life. He does not even aspire to become a personality like Brahma. He's no longer interested in any sort of materially elevated life. So we must look this way at ourselves. This is the sign that I'm making progress. I'm less and less and less interested in material life. Does that mean that we should give up all our material activities and duties? No. Srila Prabhupada firmly says no. You shouldn't do that. But you should place Krishna and pleasing Krishna as the center of your life. Now, I want to give you one last one here. There's two more with you, but I want to go through this one, which is about the dirty things. The fortunate King Maharaj Parikshit inquired further and said, O Brahmana, please describe in full detail how and where the mind has to be applied and how the conception can be fixed so that the dirty things in a person's mind can be removed. This is a very relevant one, because we all have dirty things. Now, nobody likes, if I said to you, you're a very dirty looking person, no one would feel very happy about that. They would take it as insulting. So we should understand, what is this dirt? It explains in here, what is the things that have been described as dirty? Are they that I'm a mean, nasty person, and I'm envious, and I'm cruel? No, that's not what's being referred to here. Okay. So put, please underline as you see fit. I'll tell you mine, you underline as you like. The dirty things in the heart of a conditioned soul are the root cause of all troubles for him. I underline the root cause, because that's quite a strong statement. A conditioned soul is surrounded. I underline surrounded because I get this picture of being surrounded, totally surrounded, by the manifold miseries of material existence. Surrounded by miseries. But on account of his gross ignorance, he is unable to remove the troubles due to the dirty things in the heart. He can't remove the troubles. Why? They are accumulated due to long prison life in the material world. Now, do any of us feel, some of us maybe we have had some encounters with prison life, but most of us would be thinking prison life, that's a horrible thought. Going to prison would be most unpleasant, and a person like me would never like to be find myself in prison. But the Bhagavatam states emphatically that we're all imprisoned. And sometimes we can all experience within our own mind or our own body that we've been kept a prisoner, and it's very, very uncomfortable. And we wish that we could get free. So this imprisoned life in the material world means that from time and time since we can't even imagine, we have been identifying with our situation in life, and from that situation we generate the next one. And after that we generate the next one. And it's called samsara dava nalalita loka, cycle of birth and death. We generate our next prospects to be here and remain here in the material world as a prisoner. Now, what's the option? What's the alternative? You say that is negative. Prabhupada says, he is actually meant to serve the will of the Supreme Lord. But, on account of the dirty things in the heart, he likes to serve his concocted desires. These desires, instead of giving him any peace of mind, they create new problems. So think about this. I think we can all see this in our lives. And thus bind him to the cycle of repeated birth and death. I can say for myself again that being older, now in my 50s, late 50s, I'm sometimes sitting somewhere, go down the street, somewhere, and I see a young child coming, jumping along, and they're bouncing around, they've got so much energy. And I think, oh, I remember when I used to be able to run and jump like that. And then sometimes I see somebody who's 20 or something like that, and I think, oh, I used to wear my hair like that. Or, oh, I used to wear dresses like that. Or, and I think, and I look at myself and I go, ah! And I think, and in this way, what happens is, this is how one is forming one's next birth. Because one is wishing. And this is a very important point that I discovered in my reading, was that you're thinking, we're all thinking, that I am in control of my life. I do and the result comes. When I do and the result doesn't come, I'm frustrated with myself. But what's coming now is the result of your desires in your last birth. This is your prarabdha karma. You can't change it. You have to live it out. You can change it insofar as you can become devotional. And then it can become easy to bear. But you can't change it. If you're meant to have this, it will come to you. If you're meant to have that, it comes from your last life. So all your wishes and aspirations and prayers and everything that you're doing in this life, you may sometimes feel, I'm not getting anywhere. But you are. But you will reap the results in your next life. When you become free of the things that are binding you this life, it won't be in this birth, it will be in your next birth that you will receive the fruits of your activities. So one may say, that's not fair, I don't like that, and rant and rave, or the child will when you tell them they have to do something. But these are the laws of nature. These are the laws that govern the material world. And so when we know them, and when we go along with them for the pleasure of Krishna, we have happiness even in the most distressful situation. The person can be peaceful and happy. And when we go against them, even with the most satisfactory situation around you, you'll always be feeling, yeah, but, you know, it could be a bit better this way, or it's not like that. The Bhagavatam speaks on this also, but I haven't got a verse to share with you, but you can find verses if you delve into the treasure chest of the Bhagavatam. Please, back to this. I want to go down to the second paragraph. Maharaj Parikit, now he was being told, as I told you earlier, about this, how you can see the Lord in everything, in a pantheistic way. Maharaj Parikit was already directly connected with the personal feature of the Lord, and as such he had no need to inquire from Sukadeva Goswami about where and how to apply the mind in the impersonal Virat Rupa of the Lord. But he inquired after a detailed description of the matter for the benefit of others. And what are those others? Those who are unable to conceive of the transcendental personal feature of the Lord as the form of eternity, knowledge and bliss. Now this I find very relevant, because as many times that I'm also in that category for some reason or another, that my consciousness fails and I'm unable moment to moment to think of Krishna in this absolute way, and then I have to turn to seeing everything is His. It's His energy. This is His, this is His, this is His. And this will prevent one from trying to dominate and enjoy the material world. So this is a very relevant part of what we also need to be able to do. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is explained by the Lord Himself that people with a poor fund of knowledge deride the Supreme Personality of the Lord, taking Him to be a common man. Such men are ignorant of the inconceivable potency of the Lord. Now I'm going to stop that one. You can read it yourself if you want, because I want to actually stop here, because we're not exactly following our schedule. I want you to sit if you want and continue to do this, or to take a break if your mind is getting tired. And then after a short break, I want to come back and we will write on this. What I want to do then is that you take them and you just sit somewhere quietly to yourself. You take them and the others. You can look through the others if you want and underline them if you want. But I want you just to sit with them and see if there's anything, anywhere that we have read that appears relevant to you. And I want you then to do something with it. You can do what you want with it. You can write it down so you can memorize it. You can question it. You can do what you want with it. I want you to develop that feeling that you can do what you want with this knowledge. But remember, as we heard in the beginning, that it is not that intellectually, exactly intellectually, the disciple receives these teachings, but it's by submissive inquiries and a service attitude. So if our questioning, even our doubts, are presented submissively, then we will receive reciprocation from the Bhagavatam. So can we now, just to give you a break, because we're not exactly following our schedule, but then we will continue to write after that. Thank you. Yes. So we have now...